Hello, everyone, and welcome to Shadow Talk, a weekly threat intelligence and information security podcast brought to you by the ReliaQuest threat research team. My name is Stefano, and I'm back here with Caroline and Keith for another episode. Hey, guys, how you doing?
Hey, we're doing well. Thank you for having us on.
Yeah, thank you. Doing well.
Good to hear that. Whenever I ask these questions and there are multiple people in the room, no one wants to go first. And then I'm always afraid of just like ending the podcast like that on the first question with no one asking, with no one answering. Sorry. So it's always good to hear that you're doing well.
No questions.
Well, I've tried my best. So that's it. See you next week. It's great to have you back. Really, really happy to do that. We've got a really nice podcast lined up today because we've got a really interesting topic to discuss. The first one is going to be the Cobalt Strike infrastructure takedown effort by Microsoft. Then we move to a Mercury campaign, again detected by Microsoft. Mercury, for those of you who are not too familiar with this name, is also represented with the Muddy Water name, which we discussed in the past quite a few times here at on Shadow Talk. And finally, we're going to do a brief overview of the main interesting bits coming from this week's Patch Tuesday. So we've got quite a lot to discuss. So I'd say let's get started and let's see what we're going to discuss here. So for the first topic, as I mentioned, we're going to be talking about the Cobalt Strike infrastructure takedown. And what happened here is that at the end of March, specifically on the 31st of March, the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of New York issued a court order allowing Microsoft, Fortra, and the Health ISAC to disrupt malicious infrastructure associated with Cobalt Strike. Fortra is the rightful owner of Cobalt Strike, the organization that developed this tool. And this sort of new partnership basically represents a new approach to try and mitigate the threat posed by a misuse of Cobalt Strike by threat actors. So, Keech, can you give us, the audience, like some background information on Cobalt Strike, how it's used, how it's misused, and why in the end we're talking about this new approach?
So Cobalt Strike is marketed as a threat actor simulation software. It's meant to be used by red team operators simulating the tactics, techniques, and procedures that a threat actor would take in an environment, such as moving laterally from a compromised host, elevating their privileges, harvesting credentials, et cetera. Normally, Fortra is very strict with who gets to use that software because it is so, it can let you do those threat actor techniques. So it's very powerful. It's potentially dangerous in the wrong hands. Fortra takes very rigorous steps to vet the people who are looking to purchase the software. And they also control through licensing, how long they're able to use that software, what they're able to use that software for, where they're able to host it, et cetera. Starting around Cobalt Strike version 3, there start to appear what we call cracked versions of the software, basically meaning that the software is able to be used without the oversight of Fortra through licensing. And that has allowed threat actors to abuse Fortra's software for malicious purposes. The threat actor simulation software has turned into the de facto threat actor software in this case. So this is an attempt by Fortra to take back control of their software through issuing this court order.
Cool. Yeah, no, it's good. Because what is really interesting is to see that this tool was developed for legitimate purposes, for doing red teaming and to sort of test an organization infrastructure for improving their defenses. But then, you know, with cracked version, it really became one of the most active tools used by threat actors that can use that, like both like financially motivated. We're seeing also like state sponsored actors using Cobalt Strike in the past. So it's really a widespread tool. And, you know, when I started working in this space, I was seeing Cobalt Strike being everywhere, basically whenever I was reading a news article about like a new campaign or something like that. So my first thought was like, okay, yeah, it's like a malicious tool that was developed for this purpose. I remember being like quite surprised when I discovered that it was the other way around. So that was something interesting for me as I got closer and like deeper in this space. And what you were saying about like Fortran and Microsoft cooperating in this instance is particularly interesting for me, because like it is quite a peculiar partnership, this one. Of course, Microsoft has got a lot of capabilities in this space, especially in the takedown space. We've seen that in the past on multiple occasions. But the fact that we're seeing Fortra, Microsoft, and then the New York District Court cooperating is quite peculiar in a way. So when I saw like this new partnership, I thought, okay, this is something new. They're trying to like an innovative approach, because something in the past may not have been working. So how do you think this approach is different from what we've seen in the past? And what do you expect the outcome to be here?
This is the first time we've seen legal action being taken to have just infrastructure not associated with any particular group or any particular threat actor being targeted in this way. I think Cobalt Strike is a perfect target case. In our intrusion response, the majority of the time, we are going to see Cobalt Strike beacons being dropped on infected hosts. It kind of makes sense that Microsoft would be partnering with Fortra to endeavor in this legal action, because the majority of enterprise operating systems, I want to say something around the ballpark of like 95%, don't quote me on that, is going to be Microsoft operating systems. So they have a lot to gain from having Cobalt Strike beacons, Cobalt Strike infrastructure removed from being hosted publicly, because that's also protecting their software as well, because they're probably the most common target for Cobalt Strike activity.
Yeah. So my question here is, well, like, do you expect like this new approach to have a bigger impact than what's been tried before? Or do you think it's going to be the same? Like, what do you think is going to be the magnitude of the results obtained by this new partnership and new approach?
So it's important to keep in mind that this is being brought before the court for the Eastern District of New York. So within their jurisdiction, they're only going after Cobalt Strike infrastructure that is known to be associated with the compromise of hosts geolocated in the state of New York. That's going to be a much smaller subset of all the Cobalt Strike infrastructure out there. So as far as total disruption, at least with this particular legal action, I don't think it's going to be that much. Threat actors are constantly spinning up new Cobalt Strike infrastructure as well. As those IPs and domains become known to the public, they become known IOCs for compromise that blue teams are going to be looking for with static detections. They need to keep their infrastructure fresh, so they will keep spinning up new infrastructure. So the total impact is probably going to be on the smaller side. But I think this does open the door to other legal action, perhaps at a expanded scope, perhaps all the Cobalt Strike infrastructure known to target targets within the United States, perhaps forcing ISPs and hosting providers to take down that infrastructure. That could cause a much larger disruption. In that case, we might see threat actors pivoting away from Cobalt Strike into other command and control infrastructure, such as Sliver and Brute Retail.
Cool. That's very interesting. And as we were saying, like in the preparation of the recording of this episode, It is like the sample here that we're discussing, so the sort of the scope that we're discussing in this new order, court order, like is much smaller than what could initially be thought. Because when you see like these big names cooperating, you imagine like a global takedown of all the cobalt strike infrastructure out there. But yeah, that's not going to happen yet, at least. In this case, as we were saying before, it's probably more sort of like sandbox attempt to see how this would work in practice, to sort of develop new processes, new infrastructure in place to take down cobalt strike appliances in New York first, and then move on to other other areas. I would say possibly first in the US and then move on outside as well. But yeah, it's definitely like an interesting step forward in the right direction. So it will be interesting to see and monitor how this will develop in the future. Before we move on to the second section of this episode, just wanted to ask you, Caroline, like if you had any thoughts that you wanted to share on Cobalt Strike and this new takedown approach, if you've seen these, like in your experience. I imagine you've seen a lot of Cobalt Strike in your daily work. So yeah, anything that you wanted to share here, the floor is yours.
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to echo pretty much everything that Kitch has said, but I also think it'll be really interesting to see if this makes any kind of dent. I don't really think it's going to make that much of a difference, just because for now, at least, just because they're only focused on targeted devices geolocated in New York. But like we said, this is probably just a testing ground for them, and they'll probably expand if this goes well. I'm definitely interested to see what the results of this will be.
Yeah, it's also good in general, I think, when we see like more of these like public-private partnerships going on in this space for good reasons. So yeah, that's definitely like a good sign of a sort of more maturity in this space for everyone here. So for public institutions, private entities, it's always good to see that. So I say let's move on to the second section of today's episode, and we're going to still be talking a little bit about Microsoft, because their digital crimes unit recently published like a new report highlighting a new campaign by Mercury or Muddy Water, which is a nation state, state-sponsored threat group linked to the Iranian government, that in this case attacked both on-premises and cloud environments. It was also interesting to see in this campaign how the threat actor tried to masquerade their activity as a ransomware campaign, while in fact it appeared that the ultimate goal of the campaign was destructive. So yeah, just data destruction. So Caroline, can you tell us more about who Mercury is and what's its relationship with Dev 1084, or how you pronounce it, which is another group that was identified but not named yet by Microsoft?
Yeah, sure. So like Steph said, you might recognize Mercury by their more well-known name, Muddy Water. This group was officially attributed to the Iranian Ministry of Intelligence and Security by our own U.S. Cyber Command last year. And this kind of happened around the time of Log4j, as they were seen actively exploiting that vulnerability in 2022. But there have been generally known for exploiting public-facing assets with those known vulnerabilities. And those are typically going to be for espionage purposes. Like we said, this is a group that is backed by the Iranian government. So, for example, the group was observed exploiting that Log4j vulnerability last year across Israeli organizations to plant those web shells for that remote command execution and to eventually achieve their outcome of either ransomware deployment and data destruction. And like we said, for this group, they've traditionally targeted on-prem environments, these prior cases. They haven't like strayed too far from that. But Microsoft recently detailed their evolution into moving from the initially compromised on-premise environment to conducting their impact eventually in the cloud environment. So,
Yeah, sure.
Microsoft does believe that this was made possible for them, this change in operations, through their partnership with another group that Microsoft has identified. They haven't named them yet, but they've also been seen targeting similar organizations, and then also using like similar infrastructure that is known to be Mercury-based. And that group that the name that Microsoft has given them temporarily is that Dev 1084. So Microsoft is going to use those designations just as a temporary name to give to an unknown or emerging developing cluster of threat activity. So this allows them to track it in the meantime until they get some fancy cool name like Mercury or things or like Mercury or Conti or stuff like that. So got to wait for their supervillain name.
I'm sure they're patiently waiting for that too. Well, I gotta say, I'm pleased that you pronounced Dev 1084 as I did, because I was I read the report yesterday, and in my mind, like, I didn't think about how to pronounce that, but now that I was like going to do that like online, I was like, oh shit, how do you do it?
If it's pronounced another way I'm wrong, I'm sorry.
Well, they can't complain until they have a good name. Sorry, Keith.
I don't think Dev 1084 rolls off the tongue quite as well as 1084.
Yeah, exactly. My brain was going like in two different directions. The third one could have also been like spelling each number separately. Not a good idea. So yeah, I'm glad we're on the same page here. Going back to more serious stuff, when talking about Muddy Water, I think it's interesting to see like a state-sponsored threat group operating in a way that is not simply limited to cyber espionage. As you were mentioning, Caroline, we're seeing this group conducting ransomware activity, data destruction activity. So some kind of activity that is not typically associated with these groups. We see that happening maybe like with North Korean APTs, not much so with traditional activities associated with Chinese and Russian state-sponsored groups. So it is quite peculiar. It is something to keep in mind when, you know, looking at APTs. Because, you know, when, like, from a threat intelligence point of view, when you hear APTs or state-sponsored, your brain goes directly to cyber espionage. But that's not the only thing that these groups can do. They can actually do, like, a whole lot or financially motivated or ideologically motivated cyber activity. So going back to this campaign specifically, can you give us some more information about how they conducted the operations and what Microsoft shed light to when discussing this group's activity?
Yeah, so with regards to the partnership between Mercury and that Dev 1084 group, it is believed that Mercury most likely conducted the initial access operations before passing it off to Dev 1084 for things like enumeration, lateral movement, and then eventually data impact within the cloud environment. So what they've seen so far, Microsoft researchers, is that initial access is made to those on-premise assets, typically through exposed vulnerable applications, like we discussed before with Log4j. They can then install web shells and then use that connectivity to install backdoors, RMM tools. Also, they've been seen primarily creating a local admin user, which can then conduct credential discovery and access. Their other tools or I guess techniques are pretty like in line with what we would see with any type like general lateral movement or enumeration. So they're known for using remote task scheduler, WMI, things like that. And then with regards to impact, the ransomware strain that they are known to use is referred to as Darkbit. And they've been seen in this campaign primarily It seems they're a little, like Steph mentioned, they're more concerned about the destruction of data rather than purely stealing it. But they are expelling that data as well.
So it's sort of like a dual use of the access they gain at the beginning. So they get the data first, but then they destroy it, masquerading that as a ransom operation. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Cool. That's very interesting. Also, you mentioned before, during our preparation call for this episode, that one of the most peculiar thing about this operation was the fact that they were able to move from on-premise to the cloud. So can you explain to us how that worked and how did they accomplish this?
Sure. So this movement is pretty interesting to me, just because I've recently been trying to learn more about the movements of threat actors between on-prem and cloud solutions. It's just a type of movement that's very interesting to me, and I think we have a lot to learn from it. In this case, there was two key aspects that allowed them to move from on-prem to the cloud. First was they were observed compromising two privileged accounts and leveraging them to manipulate the Azure AD Connect agent. Now, they had to make sure that they were on a machine with that agent installed. And this is going to be an on-premise application on those hosts for managing on cloud and on-prem hybrid identities through operations like password hash syncs, pass-through authentication, object syncs, et cetera. So it's just responsible for making sure that those hybrid identities are synchronized across the environment. Then the threat actors were observed using the AAD internals tool to extract plain text credentials of a privileged Azure AD account. So within that tool, there's going to be a function called get AAD in sync credentials. And that is a function that's going to allow a local admin, which we've already said that they were able to create, on a device with the Connect agent to extract plain text credentials of the AD DS connector account and the Azure AD connector account, both of which usually have the permissions that this group is looking for that is required for pivoting followed by impact eventually. And those were used to pivot from those hybrid identities were used to pivot from the on-prem environment to the Azure AD environment in this case.
Nice. Thank you for explaining that. You did a very good job. So yeah, thanks for that.
Yeah, no problem.
Kitch, is there anything that you wanted to add on this campaign? Do you have any thoughts at all?
Yeah. So if your goal is destruction, it makes a lot of sense that you would go for the double whammy, where you would focus on the on-prem, compromise that, impact that, and also impact the cloud. Mm-hmm. I remember password hash synchronization with Microsoft Azure. I forget exactly where I read it, but they quipped that the customers that were impacted by NotPetya ransomware, there were some customers that had password hash synchronization enabled and some that did not. The ones that did not lost complete access to their environment, while the ones that had password hash synchronization up to Azure were able to reestablish control of their environment, were able to rebuild and basically back up to operations very quickly. The whole point of the synchronization between Azure and on-prem, user accessibility, you just have to remember one password, all of that. You're able to access your cloud resources with your on-prem credentials. Mm-hmm. So the fact that they're targeting both of those at the same time makes a lot of sense for a destructive focused actor, as opposed to someone who's just trying to ransom get money.
That yeah. makes total sense. Yeah, so thanks for that, Kitch. That was very useful. All right, so let's move to the third and final section of today's episode, where we're going to be talking about the latest introduction to the Patch Tuesday that was released this Tuesday, which I think it was the 11th of April. So yeah, as you know, this sort of recurrence is used by by Microsoft and other organizations like Apple, Oracle, and a lot of other like big organizations to sort of inform users about important patches that are available for vulnerabilities affecting their products. I know you guys know much more about vulnerabilities than I do, so I wanted to leave the floor open to you. So is there anything in particular in this latest instance of Patch Tuesday that caught your attention that you wanted to share and like explore with the audience?
Oh boy, is there. So just to start off, there were 97 vulnerabilities in the April 2023 Patch Tuesday rollout. Of those 97, 7 of them are considered critical. There were, I believe, 2 that stuck out to me in particular. I think the one that caught my attention the most is the critical RCE vulnerability in Microsoft's message queuing, the MSMQ service. It received a 9.8 out of 10 on the CVSS vulnerability score. So that's a really big deal.
Yeah.
Definitely something that can be, I believe in Microsoft's words, you can send one maliciously crafted packet to the correct port, which I believe is 1801, to trigger remote code execution on that host with system privileges, pretty much the highest privileges you can get on a host. So it's definitely a big deal. Quick looks around in Shodan for hosts that have that open. Didn't see a whole lot of results, but I know Microsoft themselves said that there were, I believe, over 300,000 publicly available on the internet. That may be because Shodan's not scanning for that particular port. Who knows? But definitely one that sticks out to me. If you have port 1801 open at your network edge firewall, definitely something you want to get closed. If you don't require it for internal communications within your network, definitely something you want to block.
That's good advice. Thank you, Kitch. Caroline, anything from you?
Yeah, sure. So the other vulnerability that was another one that was mentioned within Patch Tuesday was actually a actively exploited 0-day that Microsoft has documented. It has to do with a vulnerability in the I just lost my notes.
That's fine.
Yes.
I forgot to say the name of mine too. I didn't want to say the word QJumper. Oh man. Sorry. We can cut that from the recording.
All right, so I'm just gonna start over.
Yeah.
All right, so another vulnerability that was mentioned by Microsoft within Patch Tuesday is classified as an actively exploited 0-day, and the abbreviation for that is going to be CVE 2023-28252.
Nice.
And this has to do with a vulnerability in the Windows Kaban Log file system driver. And this is going to be an elevation of privilege vulnerability. This specific one actually does require, this is more on the post-compromise side. So initial access is required for this one. However, this does involve a possibility of a privilege escalation to system, as Kitch just mentioned, is going to be what every threat actor's goal is going to be, is eventually getting those system privileges or whatever is equivalent to that within their host environment. And this one is rated at a 7.8, so a little bit lower than Kitch's, just because Kitch's doesn't, the one that Kitch mentioned, it doesn't really require that much. It doesn't require that post, that initial access. This one does. I don't believe so, Kitch, if that's correct. This yours is kind of more on the publicly exploitable things.
Yeah, so it's going to be something that requires little user privileges, no authentication, very low barrier to entry. If there's a vulnerable system with that port open, sending a maliciously crafted packet to that port is going to cause the vulnerability. An exploit of the vulnerability. Excuse me.
Gotcha. But yeah, that's really the one that jumped out for me, just because we have seen this exploited in the wild. It's been recently associated with a specific threat actor group or ransomware strain. And I just lost my notes again. This is going wonderfully.
That's fine. So it's
Nokoyawa, I believe.
Yes, Nokoyawa, yes.
Thank you, Keech, saving us once again. So yeah, thank you for that. Thank you both for the explanation on the vulnerabilities. I would have never been able to do that in the way you did. So I gotta say really thank you for that. Just one last question, like a more of a general question on this sort of Patch Tuesday, or like any sort of notification on vulnerabilities that come from entities, both private and public, like these ones. So if you know you're an organization, you're like a SOC manager, you work in this sphere, you see these sort of documents, you see an article discussing the latest and greatest vulnerabilities detected in products that you use in your environment, what is the first thing, like, what do you need to do in these cases in order to properly manage the threat and the risk posed by these vulnerabilities, and not just panic over the greatest critical score that has been assigned to a vulnerability that may not even be in your environment?
So it's definitely going to start with, one, having a good asset inventory list of everything you've got in your environment. For a lot of larger organizations, that's definitely a challenge. I understand that, but it's super important to have, just to be able to know what you're trying to defend. Secondly, having a verbose patching system, making sure that you're applying the latest and greatest patches for those vulnerabilities to those vulnerable systems so that they're no longer vulnerable. I can't tell you how many times we've seen, even to this day, we still see people, organizations being vulnerable to the Log4j exploit, which was on the news. Even non-cybersecurity people were aware of Log4j. If you asked them what it was, oh, I saw that on the news. But they're not keeping up with patch management, so they're still vulnerable. We need to make sure that we are keeping up with those patches.
And just as Kitch mentioned, that asset inventory is also extremely important. So we might have that patch management, but what are we looking at that was patched, right? Are there things that we are assets that are not documented in that we perhaps missed? So just because everything looks hunky dory and that everything is patched, then make sure that's truly everything.
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah.
And even if you're not able to keep up with patch management for some reason, you don't have a complete asset inventory list, the most basic of fallbacks, right, is our defense in depth approach to defending an environment and our visibility. Even if they are able to exploit one of these vulnerabilities, let's say they're able to exploit the MSMC service vulnerability, QJumper. We'll still be able to see some action that's performed by that remote code execution, right? So we're relying at that point on other rules to detect the actions that threat actor would take once they have that kind of access to a host. Making sure we have the visibility in the environment for being able to see that as well is definitely important. Really, you should be patching.
And that is the perfect mitigation strategy, like perfect comment to end this section and today's episode as well. I wish we could just take that beat and like make a TikTok and make it go as viral as possible. just patch it. So thank you for that, Keech. And yeah, I think that's everything for today's episode. Caroline Kitsch, thank you. Thank you very much for your contribution and your expertise. It's been super helpful to understand, to really understand these topics. And thank you for the audience. We reached the end of this episode. It's always nice to see you getting to the last second of it. I don't know what's the percentage of people that get here, but if you're here, thank you very much. And yeah. I'll speak to you next week. So thank you again, guys, and have a great weekend or rest of the week.